From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, stand-up comedian Keith Lowell Jensen and his new live CD, Cats Made of Rabbits. Also, soprano Rebecca Plack and her concert of songs by Jewish composers from Mahler to Sondheim. And the classical world music group Silk Road Ensemble. You'll meet two of the musicians who co-founded the group with Yo-Yo Ma. But first, budget gridlock in Sacramento and Washington. Here, after talks, weeks of talks, the governor and lawmakers decide it's time to get out of town and take their respective messages to the people of California. Meanwhile, in D.C., congressional leaders and the president hunker down to try and come up with a deal that would stop a federal government shutdown. Joining us to talk about Sacramento's budget roadshows and the expected impact on California of any federal government shutdown is Marianne Russ, Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Well, before we get to the California Budget Roadshow, let's quickly talk about what impact there would be, if any, on California if there were to be a federal government shutdown tonight.
Well, there would be an impact on California itself as far as federal employees who work in the state, national parks, and other impacts. But if we're asking specifically about the impact on California's own fragile budget situation, I did talk briefly with some folks in the Department of Finance yesterday, and they've essentially done a review of all departments that get federal dollars, and it's actually quite a few departments. But the upshot is they think there won't be a real hit to California's budget situation unless a shutdown were to go longer than a month. If it were to drag on past that, the state could start to see delays in payments or perhaps no payment at all for programs that are funded either in part or totally by the federal government. But at this point, they're not too worried. However, that the situation may change if that shutdown does drag on.
Well, and of course, California officials have their own monstrous budget deficit to deal with themselves. And they've been talking in Sacramento, it seems, endlessly for weeks, often behind closed doors. But they're doing it differently now. They're all leaving town. Why?
Yeah, actually, it is starting to feel a little bit like campaign season again. The question is, who isn't leaving town? Let me give you the rundown here. So first, the California Republican Party kicked off a series of town halls. They're calling it the California Speaks Out Tour, and they started last night in Fresno. This will involve party leaders, Republican legislators, and they plan to focus on the budget, why they oppose Governor Jerry Brown's tax extensions, and on the changes that they're asking for, which include reductions to public employee pensions, as well as a state spending cap. They've also put together a few websites as part of this campaign, including one that asks, "Where are the jobs, Jerry Brown?" Assembly Republican leader Connie Conway was at last night's event, and yesterday she talked about why she thought the town halls were a good idea.
There's always a blame game to go around, and everybody likes to point fingers at everybody else. And that's another good reason, honestly, to get out of Sacramento and get out of the dome of rhetoric and talk to real people in a language they can understand. And if there's a way to make sense of what happens here, to do that in plain language.
I like that phrase, the dome of rhetoric. It sounds like Charlie Sheen might pick that one up.
Yeah, at the press conference yesterday, when she mentioned that, several of the reporters all said, that was a good one.
So she thinks it's a good idea to get out of town and talk with people. She's not the only one.
No, she is not. Governor Brown is, of course, on his own statewide tour. Today, he will visit a Riverside elementary school. Tomorrow, he'll be in Los Alamitos. And those are, interestingly, both Republican districts. Brown's office releases his schedule only sporadically and without a lot of advance notice, so we don't know too much more about where else he will be headed. But he has told us he's going to travel the state and take his case directly to the people.
I want to give voice to the educators, to law enforcement, to firefighters throughout the state, because they see a part of California that is important and that needs the financing of the tax extensions.
Is it just a coincidence that both Republicans and the governor are hitting the road at the same time? And if not, do we know who started it?
Well, the governor's been talking about this for a few weeks, but you can imagine that the Republicans' tour has taken quite a bit of time to plan. They are partnering with local radio stations, and they already have, let's see, 7 tour dates planned up through July 21st and more to be announced. So while I can't say for certain who was first, it seems to me that the Republican California Speaks Out tour by the party has certainly taken quite a bit of advance planning.
So the governor, who's a Democrat, is going on the road. What about Democratic lawmakers?
Yes, actually, we learned yesterday that the legislative budget committees are also apparently going to hold some hearings on the road. We don't have a lot of details about that, but Democratic Senate Leader Daryl Steinberg says that the Senate Budget Committee will focus on the effects of an all-cuts budget.
Without panicking people, because, you know, that never is the way to make an impact here. It's our responsibility to describe for local communities what it would look like.
Well, after all this kind of legislative spring break, what will happen when they all get back to town?
If only I knew the real answer to that, Jeffrey. The hope would be that at some point here around May 15th, we'll hear from Governor Brown, and he will give us his revised budget. That's something that the governor has to do every year by law. And he has already said that he's going to wait until then to make any sort of decision about whether to try to go to the voters about the tax extensions. So we'll hear from the governor, and he says his revised budget will probably include alternatives. So that may mean perhaps an all-cuts budget, perhaps going to the voters through the initiative process. He has still indicated that he would love to reach a deal with Republican lawmakers. But it's been a very interesting timeline this year. You know, this sort of construct that was created by the governor because he wanted to have a June election where we had a lot of budget talks very early in the year. But really, the budget deadline is June 15th. And lawmakers actually very rarely meet that constitutional deadline. So I think we're looking at more of a move to the traditional budget year calendar that we often see, where they do tend to wait until the revised budget comes out in May. They'll have the new revenue estimates. They'll know exactly what they have to work with. And then they perhaps will start talking again.
There was such a focus on trying to get a budget deal passed earlier in this year. So I guess now that it's certain that there won't be a June election and that the June 15th deadline is months away, at least a couple of months away, there's probably going to be less impetus, I guess, at least in the short term, on getting a budget passed.
Probably. And I think that's why we're seeing people headed out on the road. And in a sense, it's sort of a marketing campaign for each group to sort of make their case for what they see as the best possible scenario, you know, at this point. It's also important to point out that lawmakers did tackle a chunk of the deficit. They still have about $15.4 billion left to deal with, but they have dealt with $11.2 billion. That's what has passed and the governor has signed at this point. So that is, you know, a little bit unusual to have that much of the deficit dealt with by this point in the fiscal year.
Anything else of note going on in Sacramento around the Capitol?
Well, always informal budget talks. You know, there's always a lot that we wish we could be the fly on the wall behind the closed doors, because you'll hear about these informal meetings or somebody saw somebody else in the hallway. And there's a lot of this on Twitter, of course. So there's always those sort of things going on, conspiracies about who's really talking with who and what the real plan is. But at this point, I think we're looking at a lot of people heading out of town, and we will have to wait until they come back, until we really get some progress on the budget.
And we'll just close by noting that Governor Brown just celebrated his 73rd birthday. And as I understand, he's just a few days away from being the oldest sitting governor in California history.
He is actually a couple of weeks away, if I understand it right. April 19th was the date that I read. So, yeah, he was already the oldest governor elected, oldest to be elected. But apparently on April 19th, he will surpass the oldest ever sitting governor. So
yeah.
There you go.
Very good. Well, thanks so much, Marianne Russ, Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, stand-up comedian Keith Lowell Jensen and his new live CD, Cats Made of Rabbits. Thank you. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Go to our webpage. It's capradio.org/insight. There's lots there. Information about our show, our topics, our guests, also links to follow our show on Facebook and me on Twitter. It's capradio.org/insight. This morning on Talk of the Nation Science Friday, topics include the genetics of Alzheimer's, also celebrating the 50th anniversary of one of the most notable feats in human history. On April 12, 1961, Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin was the first person to go into space. And can science inspire great art? Can art inspire great science? Guests include film director Werner Herzog. That's Talk of the Nation Science Friday, right after Insight at 11.
I want you guys to give a loud Comedy Spot welcome to Keith Lowell Jensen.
That's the start of Cats Made of Rabbits, a new live CD and DVD by Sacramento stand-up comic Keith Lowell Jensen. He's in our studio. Keith, welcome back to Insight.
Oh, thanks, thanks. And thanks for playing all that heady, brainy stuff before you introduced me.
It's like... Yeah. Who was that introducing you? I love the way he does this sort of Oprah Winfrey style. Jensen!
I'm going to tell him that you compared him to... So Oprah Winfrey, that's Chaz Hawkins. And so now you're saying not only do all black people look alike, but they all sound alike.
Way to, I did not
way to start it with
that.
The racism, Jeffrey.
I didn't even know the anything
deep.
About this. Seriously, though, where was that recorded and when?
At the Sacramento Comedy Spot in June of last year. And the idea was to put out an album a year. That's the goal we've been working on. But
you didn't make that because your previous album, To the Moon, came out two years ago.
Yeah, the reason we didn't make that is I always pride myself on being an independent artist, and I was trying really hard not to be. So for 7 months, I had a label that had me sort of on the hook considering it, and I'm just totally flattered that they took 7 months to say no.
So you had an actual label saying, Keith Lowell Jensen, we're in talks with your peeps?
Yes. I went and met with them in New York, and they came and saw me live, and they're really excited about working with me, and they claim still to be excited about working with me. And I'm like, okay, well, I got to get this album out because I already had to cut one joke from it because it expired.
You know? Why? Because it was political?
No. I wish it was something that brainy. No, it had a Jonas Brothers reference. Nobody remembers the Jonas Brothers. That's the nice thing about politics being so stagnant right now. It's, you know, you can keep talking about healthcare for a long time, unfortunately.
Yes. Well, fame can be fleeting for the famous, but when you're less famous, I guess it's less fleeting.
Is that true?
Yeah. Well, we would know.
Yes, we would.
Now, speaking of this label that you were in talks with, that decision influenced the label, or the cover, rather, of your CD, didn't it?
That was my consolation prize. I found this really great, disturbing piece of artwork by a local artist, and the label wanted nothing to do with it. I mean, they were that much, you know, they were that heavily interested in it that they even had me submit some covers. And so we submitted two that had a nice photo of me. And then we submitted that one, which is my favorite.
The disturbing one being a picture of what appear to be naked women from the waist up, but their heads are the heads of rabbits, and they're applying mascara and makeup to themselves.
Yes.
It's an odd picture.
It's a very strange picture, and it catches attention. And I feel like it sort of catches the same kind of sense of humor that I have on the album, which is this, like, innocent and dark kind of all at the same time. So I really like it. And so that's my consolation prize. I don't get to sell out and be on a major label, but I do get to have, you know, a cat painting that I wouldn't have otherwise had.
My guest is the stand-up comedian Keith Lowell Jensen. His new CD, DVD, is out. It was recorded live on stage in Sacramento, and it's called Cats Made of Rabbits. Well, you talked about your humor, which sometimes is on the darker side. Let's listen to an excerpt of that. This is where you are. Well, you start off talking about people who come to the door, knocking on the door, religious type people, and you decide to give
one of them,
or someone who you think is a religious person, a shock by answering the door naked.
Buck naked, I answer the door. Hello, how you doing? Oh, beautiful day today, isn't it? The guy's like kind of freaked out. He backs up and I'm right on him. I'm like, whoa, wait. You came to my door for a reason. He's working really hard to maintain eye contact, you know. Like, come on, give it to me. And finally, after a few awkward moments, he says, hello, I'm here today to let you know that I'm your new next door neighbor. And I'm required by law to let you know that I moved into the neighborhood. Really? Interesting. Kind of hard to make small talk at that point, isn't it? Megan's Law, huh? I've heard of it. What they get you for? Well, voyeurism. Excellent. Why don't we just call this a freebie then, shall we?
That is so funny. I wish I didn't have this image in my mind.
Yeah. Thank you. You're saying I wouldn't be someone you'd want to see answer the door naked? And that's what I say earlier in the joke, is I say that answering the door naked may not work for some people. You just end up with a doormat full of gawkers. I word it differently, but then again, we're on the radio right now.
Now, that was inspired by, you know, the way that some religious groups go around knocking on people's doors. And You've been doing religious-inspired humor as at least part of your act for some time because of another thing that you're involved in.
The Coexist Comedy Tour, it started me as sort of the atheist comedian, which is a brand that I haven't discouraged. I'm totally stoked with it, but it backfires on you sometimes. I've had gigs where people are like, well, we booked you, but then we found you on the internet, and I'm not sure that this will go over in our little town. And I'm like, well, I don't have to talk about that. You know, but the truth is I like that joke in particular about the people knocking on your door, because even people that are religious themselves don't necessarily want to be associated with the fanatics and are also annoyed by them. And so it actually bridges, you know, it's something we have in common. Like, you don't like people knocking on your door? Us either. And then we laugh, you know, at the expense of the door knockers, who then I can also relate to the door knockers and I appreciate their passion. If you are religious, it's what you're supposed to do. You know? So it divides less than you would think. And I've performed this in places like Winnemucca, Nevada, and it's done fine. And they have a good laugh. And the one time it backfired me, I was in I was in Dixon. And apparently they don't have door knockers in Dixon.
At least
that's what the audience told me. And I said, well, how is that? And one voice from a guy sitting at the bar who I didn't think was listening to me said, this is Dixon. We got guns. I was like, okay, very good. So I moved on.
Yeah, I guess that could be a good, that could be a pretty compelling reason not to knock on people's doors in an unsolicited way. Why is your record called Cats Made of Rabbits?
I have no idea what clips you're playing, but it's the last track on the album.
Yeah, we're not playing that one.
Okay, good. It's me talking about when I'm driving in between actual places. You know, most of the country is not actual places. It's the place in between actual places. And when I'm in those places and I stop at a truck stop for a sandwich and maybe a religious self-help book, they have these cats. They look like taxidermied cats. They're super realistic little kittens. And they're actually made of rabbits. And I just I just go on and on about what a bizarre thing that is. I mean, you know, if they
I'm glad they're not made of cats.
Exactly. But why? Why are we, like, bunnies are cute too. Or like, what if
and
they were
pets.
Just taxidermied bunnies? Like, yeah. Would taxidermied bunnies be acceptable to sell at a truck stop? Would we be okay with that? I've never seen taxidermy for sale at a truck stop unless it's an animal made into another animal, which should be more disturbing, not less. You know, that's like...
That's an excellent point. My guest is Keith Lowell Jensen. His new CD is called Cats Made of Rabbits, as we've just been discussing. It was recorded live on stage in Sacramento. Another thing that you talk about in your routine is a very significant event that happened in your life not too long ago, and that was when you became a father.
Yeah, almost 18 months ago.
Yeah.
Did
your wife,
Maxine.
What did your wife think about you using that as part of your act?
I have never, ever done comedy at my wife's expense. A lot of comedians go on stage and it's the ball and chain or the Woody Allen's The Dread Mrs. Allen, which she actually sued him over. I love my wife very much. I love my baby very much. And so even though I might share stuff that might be a little embarrassing or a little private, she's a very private person. she's very, especially she sees a lot of my friends perform. She's very appreciative of how generously I speak of her and of my baby and of fatherhood. And it's positive while it's embarrassing. So she figures it's all right.
Well, let's listen to one of your jokes about your own experience of childbirth.
Isn't that funny the way guys get credit for that one? We didn't do shit, you know? My wife went through 36 hours of labor. 36 hours of labor to have this kid. And the hardest part for me was staying awake for that long. She ended up having to get an epidural, and I got a mocha. Push, honey. This is fun. You ask me how childbirth was, I can answer honestly. Delicious and chocolatey.
That is so funny. Your answer to the situation of how to handle your wife's desire for privacy is to make fun of yourself in the whole process.
There's that too, yeah. I mean, if anyone's the butt of the joke, it's going to be me. It's not going to be my wife or my baby, you know.
Why would a very private person marry a stand-up comedian?
She is so funny. And I so often am saying things on stage that she thought of. She's actually written a lot of jokes for me. I think that a private person enjoys seeing someone do, you know, the whole opposites attract thing. I mean, me and my wife are a lot alike in a lot of ways, but I think she really enjoys seeing me be able to be so public and you know, go up in front of people. And I think she really enjoys seeing me repeat something that she said to me. And when it gets a big laugh, she's proud as well as me, you know.
Let's listen to one more clip from Keith's CD, Cats Made of Rabbits. This starts out as another bit of humor relating to your fatherhood, but then there's a twist added.
What's fun after you have the kid, though, is getting to insist that everyone else make the whole world child-friendly on your behalf. I love that. I just lie in wait as other comedians come off stage. Hey, I really didn't appreciate that pedophile joke. I'm a father. Yeah, that's fun. I work so much better than my old line, which was, hey, I really didn't appreciate that pedophile joke. I'm a pedophile.
And then you go on to say, speaking of pedophiles, I'm an uncle too.
Right. Just that whole stereotype. Yeah. That, it's so funny that you played that one after asking me what my wife thinks, because she hates that joke. That's like her. She wishes I wouldn't tell it. But it's not about her, so she can't really pull the whole, like, you know, putting her foot down on me. So,
Keith, it's a really funny record, but I just want to make sure we have time to ask about something that about you that's been sort of, I wouldn't say in the news, but it's been public, and that is a feud that you've gotten into with the host of an afternoon show on another radio station, Don Geronimo of 1140. What happened?
You know, it blew up so quickly. He came and saw a show that I did in Galt. And he went there to make fun of it. It's in Galt, you know, like, let's go to the small town and make fun of the comedy show. It was an awesome show. If anyone from Galt is listening, I love you, Galt. We had so much fun and it went really well. And then to get on Monday and hear him bagging on the show. So I just tweeted, how can I be made fun of by such a hack? Because I just don't like talk radio. I never have, you know, and by talk radio, I obviously don't mean NPR. I mean, well, now I don't want to name names and start more feuds, but you know who I mean. Don Geronimo's genre. It yes. doesn't appeal to me. Well, then a little Twitter war started, and he feuds all the time. That's his thing. So I thought, cool, like, this will be fun. And I just tried to be sharp and respond as best I could. He was serious. Like, I mean, I ran into him in person, and he was upset. His wife told him to just walk away from me. I was like, just walk away, as opposed to what? Like, hit me? Like, it was really a scare. And at that point, I was like, okay, I'm kind of done with this, and I let it go. But his fans
And he's
were not,
got a lot of fans in Sacramento, but he's also
but the ones
known
that
elsewhere.
Replied to me weren't mighty in number.
Really?
They were mighty in volume.
Yes.
Because I made it so you couldn't post anonymously to my blog, so it came down to just three or four guys over and over and over and over again. And I even pulled a trick and responded. There were two that I suspected were the same person. So I responded to one by the other's name, and he replied without even noticing. So I was like, ah.
And has it been resolved?
The resolution is that I stopped fighting. It's kind of hard to fight by yourself.
Yes.
So he seems to have let it go as well.
Yes. You April fooled me on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
Because on April 1st, you said that, you'd resolved it with him. And I went, oh, isn't that cool?
I was so worried about inflaming the whole thing by doing that. But yeah. I couldn't resist it. Like, I couldn't resist a good April Fool's joke. And so I posted.
Well, now I'm going to get into feud with you.
Right. I posted that I was going to be on his show on April 1st, and a lot of people fell for it. Like, do you not own calendars? How did you fall for that one, Jeffrey?
I don't know. I was so looking out for things. I trust you too much, Keith.
I look forward to exploiting that again sometime.
Yes. Cats Made of Rabbits, it's the new CD, DVD, recorded live on stage in Sacramento by stand-up comedian Keith Lowell Jensen. Keith, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, soprano Rebecca Plack and her concert this weekend of Jewish music. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Many famous composers of songs are and were Jewish, and you can hear many of them at a concert this weekend in Sacramento. Soprano Rebecca Plack will perform classical, opera, folk melodies, and Broadway show tunes, all by Jewish composers or from Jewish tradition. She's sung classical and other kinds of music in many venues in North America and Europe. She lives in Davis. Rebecca Plack, welcome back to Inside.
Thanks so much, Jeffrey.
What gave you the idea for this concert, and how on earth did you manage to whittle down all these songs by Jewish people?
Well, as you imply, the whittling down was the really difficult part. But I guess the idea came to me because I've just been performing all these different genres all my life. I started singing in synagogues as a cantor, leading services when I was 12, and just all these different genres seemed to come together, and I thought it would be a good idea.
Give us examples of some of the composers, the diversity of composers that you'll be singing on Sunday.
So some of the classical composers include Mendelssohn and Mahler, who were celebrating the 100th anniversary of his death this year. Also Zemlinsky. All of them were German, Viennese, Jewish composers. That's on the classical side. And on the musical theater side, that was really hard to whittle down. We've got Gershwin and Arlen and Irving Berlin and Jerome Kern, Stephen Sondheim, the list goes on.
Pretty much the American songbook.
That's right, sure is.
So there's a lot to choose from.
There was.
Yeah. My guest is the soprano Rebecca Plack. She is giving a concert this Sunday afternoon at 3 at the Center at 2300. It's a concert celebrating Jewish music from throughout the centuries. Now, we don't have any of the songs recorded that you're going to be singing this Sunday, but we do have something of you singing a song that is has a strong Jewish connection, and it's called In the Sky. Could you tell us what this is?
Yeah, this is a song that was... It was written by a 12-year-old boy in the Vilna ghetto in 1941, and it was recorded by an English musical theater cabaret singer named Maria Friedman. That's about as much as I know about it. I myself have a personal connection to this song because my family came from Vilna, though luckily before 1941. Mm.
This was recorded where and when?
This was recorded in a concert live in 2003, arranged by the pianist who was playing in that concert.
And he's Jonathan Summers?
Jonathan Summers, that's right.
The singer is my guest, Rebecca Plack, and this is from the song In the Sky.
Take my prayer and take my yearning. These are everything I own. In my head a fire is burning, but my heart has turned to stone. Cellars seethe with hell and fire, streets are paved with black despair.
It's pretty astonishingly mature music for a 12-year-old and heartbreaking to think about the circumstances under which you wrote it.
Yeah, for sure. I have a feeling that the music may have been a folk song, a pre-existing folk song, and that the 12-year-old may have written the lyrics. But I'm not sure. I haven't been able to find out any more about it.
Now, at this concert you're giving on Sunday afternoon, there's a lot of music by Jewish composers and music from Jewish musical tradition, but you're also going to be honoring the legacy of a Jewish opera singer, Lotte Schörner.
That's right.
Who is she? Who was she?
She was the reigning diva at the Berlin State Opera until the Nazis came to power in 1933. She was born in around 1890 in Vienna, and she was beautiful, just a beautiful singer and a really well-known figure to the Berlin public.
Now, we have a clip that you sent us of her singing.
That's right.
What is it?
It's a duet from Donizetti's Don Pasquale. And I think it just really exemplifies the beautiful lilting singing that she did.
And this was recorded in 1931. Wow. If a bird could sing like a human, that's what it might sound like. It's just astonishing.
Isn't it? Yeah, and just so all the more sad to think that her career was cut short just a couple years after that, really in her prime.
And how are you going to feature her work in your concert?
Well, I learned when I was doing some research for my doctorate that she had originally been asked to record some songs by Hugo Wolf, for a very special collection that made a lot of singers famous. But because she was on the run from the Nazis at the time when she was asked, her first recordings were not of high enough quality to be released, and then she was unable to re-record them because she had a breakdown, she went into hiding, and so on. So I discovered these recordings and discovered the reasons that they'd been eliminated from the collection. So I'm planning to perform the songs that she would have recorded for this collection in the concert on Sunday.
Finally, Rebecca, it's an unfairly huge question for the literally 2 minutes that we have left, but why do you think so many great composers are or were Jewish?
Well, I think I know that just for musical theater composers, for example, you know, there was such a strong tradition of Yiddish theater. And for immigrants to this country, entertainment, I think, was a way for people to get started. And I think among Jews, there was such a strong musical tradition. There's a lot of music making that happens in the family. There are a lot of services that don't happen publicly in synagogues, but they actually take place privately in homes. So I think for all those reasons, there's just a really strong tradition of music making.
In the synagogues, you mentioned you had started out as a singer, as a cantor.
I did. And in fact, I made my professional debut on public television.
Really?
Yeah. Back when I was about 8 or 9. So singing in a Passover Seder that happened to be recorded by KQED.
And rabbis often have good singing voices. That's been my experience.
It's true. Yeah. Yeah.
Rebecca Plack, soprano. She gives a concert this Sunday afternoon at 3 at the Center at 2300. That's on Sierra Boulevard in Sacramento. She'll be singing classical, opera, folk melodies, and Broadway show tunes, all by Jewish composers or from Jewish tradition. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, the Silk Road Ensemble. You'll meet two members who co-founded the group with cellist Yo-Yo Ma. Thank you. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and there's no Insight on Monday. Instead, at 10, you'll hear another edition of Radio Lab, a great program. Insight will return on Tuesday. The classical world music group, the Silk Road Ensemble, is coming to town. They play the Mondavi Centre at UC Davis tonight. The group's most famous member is cellist Yo-Yo Ma, but it was actually started by a group of musicians, some of whom are still with the group, and they include Colin Jacobson, who's a violinist, and Kehan Kalhor, who plays a Persian bowed string instrument called the Kamanche. I spoke with them both a little while ago and started by asking Kehan, what does Silk Road mean in this context? Why is the group called Silk Road Ensemble?
Well, first of all, the name was predetermined before I came to the project, but I think the Silk Road has a some kind of connotation that suggests the interrelation between different cultures, and in this case, musically. And the whole project has been revolving around the idea of Silk Road and what really this cultural relationship between different cultures existed before, and we try to, I think, somehow project that in a modern sense of the word.
And you are from, you were born in Iran, which I suppose was on or near the original Silk Road.
Oh, several different roads that, you know, are counted as Silk Roads in the old old times passed from Iran, and there were the Nishabur and the Khorasan province in Iran, and then eastern Iran. You know, there were several different roads that passed Iran in that time.
And Colin Jacobson, you play the violin. Mm-hmm. What drew you to the Silk Road Ensemble? Because that musical tradition from the old Silk Road is not what you were raised in, I suppose.
No, though, one thing that has happened over the years is discovering how what we used to think of as a pure Western classical music tradition really is influenced by many things, and isn't nearly as insular as one might believe. But when the Silk Road Ensemble started, I was just basically out of school or even still in school. So it was at a time when I was, particularly curious about the world, and I think Yo-Yo was looking for like-minded people who were willing to try something different, and so it's been a great 10-year journey now.
You joined the Silk Road Ensemble after it was already started then?
No, Kehan and I both came the very first summer at Tanglewood, where there was a workshop, and Kehan's piece was one of the original commissions, so we met there, and out of that experience, an ensemble sort of formed, and more of a band identity took root over years.
And Kehan, what were you doing, and where were you doing it before you got involved in the Silk Road Ensemble?
Well, I come from a musical culture that's mostly for solo music, or, I did my solo shows and duo shows, different trios with musicians from different cultures. I was involved in the kind of activities I normally am involved with. But the Silk Road suggested a new approach to what I did, and in several ways, I was looking for the similar kind of activity or the project for several reasons. First of all, mixing all this amazing composers and musicians together in one project, you have the opportunity to interact with them, to see them, and to be with them on tour. So several different musical categories actually emerged from that. And this was one very, very important benefit for me. Plus, we all started the Silk Road as musicians who were coming from different disciplines and different musical cultures, and never had a chance to approach other audiences. For example, Western classical music audience got the chance to see musicians from China, well, master musicians actually from China, from Middle Eastern countries, from Iran to be particular, and Korea, I don't know, Colin, you help me here from other, other cultures. And, you know, it was a great opportunity for us to be presented in another context. Plus, you know, our audience and, you know, the who usually listen to traditional classical music of our parts of India or Iran and other cultures, you know, they had the chance to come to listen to other musicians from Western classical music world. And it's a very, very nice combination of different musical cultures mm-hmm. that try to speak in a uniform language.
Colin Jacobson, as I understand, the Silk Road Ensemble is quite a sprawling group of people, and it's not a necessarily a fixed group of people at one time.
That's true, yeah. Between one tour and the next, there will be different personnel and rep. I mean, there's sort of a body of literature that has been created over the years through commissions and through people within the group writing and arranging stuff. So it really depends on many factors, and I think the Silk Road office, you know, has to work hard to figure out what any particular tour is going to be. But, you know, in a way, there it isn't fixed, but there sort of is, you know, a core that is generally there, and that is, you know, at least for the last number of years, there's been string quartet, bass, and three guys who play basically any kind of percussion instrument, you know, there, and then Kahan is often there, or Wu Man, a great pipa player from China who lives in San Diego, comes on some tours. I believe she's going to be on this one. And Wu Tong comes from China, who's a traditional Sheng player, mouth organ. And sometimes Sandeep Das from India comes. So it's usually around 12 to 15 people. You know, early on in the project, there were some festivals where there were like 25 people within one concert, but it's sort of become more focused over the years.
I'm talking with two composers and original members of the Silk Road Ensemble, which is playing at the Mandavi Center at UC Davis on April 8th, Friday, April 8th. Colin Jacobson plays the violin, and Kahan Kalhor plays the Comanche. And let's listen to some music now recorded by the Silk Road Ensemble. We'll start with a piece that was composed by Kahan. This is Gallop of a Thousand Horses. Kahan, are we hearing the Comanche in that excerpt?
Yes, you are.
It's such dramatic and inspiring music. What's the story behind it? Were you literally inspired by horses?
Definitely, because I was asked to write a short, fast piece for this combination of instruments, and then northeastern part of Persia or Iran, you know, called Turkmen Sara, you know, they're horse people, and a lot of horses, so I use the Turkmen melody to as a main theme in this piece. And because I've actually grown up with horses and, loved horses, always, so that was a very good excuse to involve horses in there.
Is this a... Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just... Kahan does love horses. I've heard him talk about them a few times.
I see. Is this piece? Are you going to be playing this piece at the Mandavi Center?
I'm not very sure, but I think that's programmed. Yes.
Okay. We're talking with members of the Silk Road Ensemble. We have another piece from a different record. The one we just heard was from the CD Beyond the Horizon. This next one is from the CD, a more recent one called Off the Map, also recorded by the Silk Road Ensemble. And this is from Air to Air, and it's called Wa Habibi. Now, Colin Jacobson, that music sounds so authentically from Southwest Asia, perhaps, but the composer is from Argentina.
Oh, so yeah, that was by Osvaldo Golioff, who is from Argentina, but is a musical omnivore. So he's able to put together seemingly disparate elements into, you know, many pieces of his. And he's a great musician, and he loves. There are a lot of composers out there, but there are few who I feel like when they're listening to music actually derive as much pleasure as Osvaldo. But that piece, Wahabibi, where you actually just stopped it, is where Kahan's voice comes in with a very beautiful slow melody. So that whole movement is one of huge contrast between, a very intense rhythmic section with roots in the Middle East. And actually both that and the slow section are, but that's kind of like a gypsy section, what you yes. just heard. And then it goes into a Christian Arab Easter service music.
And is there a story behind this piece from Air to Air?
Let's see. Each movement sort of has a different, it's like a suite of pieces. Each movement sort of has a different story to it. So there's another movement in there that is taken from a ritual for the Holy Mother of Guadalupe. So sort of a South American, Mexican sort of holy ritual. And it's very beautiful the way he scores it and sort of mixes that with Mahler-esque, achingly long string lines with some pre-recorded tape. And then there's a movement that's a protest song from Sardinia, which is a wild romp that ends the piece. And, it's a real journey maybe one of the pieces that has all of the members of the Silk Road Ensemble on stage at the same time.
Kahan Kalhor, could you describe the instrument you play, the Comanche?
The Comanche is a very, very old bowed instrument, and it has a long neck and a brown-shaped belly, which is covered with a piece of skin that the bridge falls in it. It has four skins, and it's probably the oldest bowed instrument of the Central Asia.
And how tall is it? How long is it?
The neck, including the peg box and the piece of ornament, probably around 50 centimeters, which is 20 inches. And 4 inches are for the peg box, and then the neck itself, from where the strings fall on the bridge to the length of the strings, is about 15 inches.
Yeah, and we actually use the same strings on the violin and the Comanche.
I see.
These days. Originally, Kahan, the Comanche used silk strings, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That was changed in the turn of the 20th century, and they used sealing strings as well.
Well,
but our string length is the same, so we actually play the same range, basically.
Correct.
Well, it's kind of a nice touch that this instrument used silk strings at one time, given the name of the ensemble.
Oh, yes.
Right. Yeah, the pipa, too. Wu Man's Chinese lute used to use silk strings and now use metal strings.
The Silk Road Ensemble at the Mondavi Center at UC Davis, Friday, April 8th. Colin Jacobson and Kahan Kalhor are both composers and original members of the ensemble. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you,
Jeffrey.
And that's Insight for this week. We're back on Tuesday. Thank you for listening.